Welcome to KPMG Texas Trend Talks, where we deliver fresh insights on major business issues. At KPMG, our people make the difference every day, so we hope you find today's podcast valuable. Thanks for joining us.
Welcome to the Texas Trend Talks podcast. I'm your host, Ashley White, Audit Managing Director at KPMG, joined by Scott Woods, tax partner and tax credit practice leader here at KPMG. And we are thrilled to be in conversation with a very special guest, Ashley Baum. Ashley is a managing director with the Texas Teachers Retirement System, where she leads the Special Opportunities Platform. So Ashley, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for being here.
Awesome. To get us started, we'd love to hear your take on something, a topic that we've all been talking about. Why private credit? What's the buzz? What's making this such a fast-growing and popular asset class right now?
Sure. Well, I think we can all agree that if you look at Bloomberg or CNBC or any articles, you see private credit in the headlines almost daily. We kind of joke around. It's a bit like clickbait at this point for institutional investors, because the minute you see private credit in the headlines, you know you're going to get a lot of interest. So what's really behind that? Well, let's think about where most people are as far as investors. What we have is we've had a period of increased volatility in the equity markets. I think we've all seen markets are going up and down, but we can all agree we're at kind of what we consider price to perfection type of equities. And so many of us are looking at our world and saying, all right, what do we believe the go forward returns for equities are going to be globally as well as here in the US? And when you look at that, which many of us do on a routine basis, what most people are saying and what came out of our 2024 strategic asset allocation study is an expectation of a forward 10-year return of around 7% out of US equities. That is a lot lower than what you would think historically. And so the interest in private credit has a lot to do with the fact that 7% for equities doesn't sound nearly as attractive as it used to in the past. Whereas we can look at private credit today, and with the SOFR rate, which most private credit is based off of, being north of 4%, you're looking at an 8 to 9% type of return profile unlevered on an asset class that has significantly less volatility than equities. And when most investors are in a position of trying to make a 7 to 8% long-term rate of return, if you can do that with an asset class that has less volatility and is actually making north of what you're expected to make, it's considered just a good alternative to both equities because it's less volatile with a more known return profile and superior to what people used to have, which would be public credit. And so public credit, if you want to take U.S. Treasuries, that same 2024 study would estimate that the 10-year forward return for U.S. equities, or excuse me, U.S. Treasuries would be around 4.6%. So you're looking at sub 5. So here's a place in which you're getting a more fixed income type return profile, floating rate, and it's looking very competitive relative to equity on a risk basis and certainly superior to public credit on a spread and return basis. So that's really what most of us are looking at.
So that's great. And, so obviously people are looking for returns, like you said, and that's going to drive more people into the space. And as someone who tries to deploy capital in the private credit, what is the current competitive environment out there for those trying to invest in the space?
I would say we have a joke, everyone and their dog is raising a private credit fund. I would say, you know, in the early days of private credit, which, you know, let's be honest, it's not a new asset class, right? We've been making loans probably since the days of the Sumerians. This what's really changed about it is the capital formation around it and the number of people that are using it as an alternative to their fixed income portfolios. So what most people looked and said was, you know, when we were in the zero interest rate environment coming out of COVID, you looked and you said, well, where can I deploy capital? I'm not getting much, if anything, out of my fixed income books. If I can trade a small amount of illiquidity to generate another 300 to 400 basis points of return, that's a really great trade because I probably don't really need that liquidity. And that's where the initial allocations were. I think most people were looking like, here is a public credit or a US Treasury portfolio that's making very little money. I can use a little bit of illiquidity and make a significant amount more. And so the initial allocations were really people taking their fixed income portfolios and putting a little bit more into it. We also had the benefit of the fact that the majority of private credit is a floating rate instrument type. And by floating rate, I mean it's going up and down, and so you don't have interest rate volatility. that's really attractive when we start to see interest rates rising by 550 basis points overnight. And I guess I should say 530 instead of 550. But not overnight, but you basically have the protection that you don't have in the public credit. So then you combine that and say, wait, well, when I look at my base rate and I look at my spread, now I'm starting to look pretty attractive relative to even private equity. That is really what's gotten everybody really interested. And so everyone is raising money. One of the continual things that we've seen, you know, I would say in 2015, I would say I saw a pitch book a day. I would say today, now in 2025, 10 years later, I think we probably see 4 or 5 pitch books every single day. And everyone has seen this as the largest growth area for their individual firms. It also has a lot of attractive qualities for insurance companies and retail, which is picking up on the trend of alternative asset managers using both insurance and retail money to increase their growth. So everyone's been very happy with it. And what that's done in our minds is actually made it slightly less attractive because there's so much competition, particularly if you think about what we would consider the plain vanilla direct lending. So the normal loans to sponsor-backed or private equity-backed companies. Well, now there's so much competition that there could be 50 or 100 different private credit firms competing to make that loan. So that's driven down the spread. It's also significantly eroded what we consider to be the legal protection, so the covenants inherent in a loan document. So for us in general, while we understand that for many people, this is still very superior, we're more attracted now to the more esoteric types of the private credit landscape. So looking into things like regulatory capital relief transactions, which is where you are allowing a bank or other regulatory agency to lower their cost by effectively writing them insurance. You can look into real estate credit. You can look into asset-backed finance, which is definitely a huge area of growth, which is where we now have private credit playing a role in buying student loan portfolios, credit card portfolios, everything from, you know, your HELOC mortgages or second liens. I mean, they're really aircraft finance. There's so many different pieces of private credit that it really is a very large umbrella. And so the answer around the competitive environment really depends on which part of private credit you're talking about.
Well, it sounds like there's still a lot of attractiveness depending on which route you want to take. I'd like to flip our conversation a little to talk more about a topic that sometimes doesn't seem attractive, regulation. We all know that it is always a moving target in the private market. And as we look at where we are in the current regulatory landscape, what changes are you seeing that are truly impacting our private credit space? And are there any that you guys are paying close attention to that you feel would be more impactful or impact your business from a long-term perspective?
I would say, you know, what's most interesting at this point is private credit is often being compared to a shadow banking system, meaning, you know, this is where private credit funds are being seen as someone who is competitive to banks, stepping into a role where banks were traditionally providing credit instrument and financing instruments, but they didn't have the same regulation. And so you've had a big pushback of traditional banks kind of going to regulators and saying, hey, aren't you worried? You're allowing people to step in and do this business activity that was highly regulated, and now it's being done outside of a regulatory framework. And what you've seen at this point has not really been a lot of proposals around regulation, but a lot of studies, a lot of work around what is the size of this market, what are the systematic implications if there were to be a problem here. And so recently, you know, just looking at the CFA Institute does a great job keeping a list of all the different regulatory items that are going on. And so they alone are highlighting that the Fed, the IMF, and the Bank of International Settlement have all come out recently with papers studying the impact. We know the SEC is looking at it as well. And so there's a lot of potential for regulation, but nothing we've seen yet. Interestingly, I would say the regulatory environment that I think could impact private credit the most in the very near term would actually be if there were to be a change in the insurance regulations. So the insurance companies who are large users of private credit and are increasingly getting active in the space in the lower risk part of the private credit universe, they actually have very attractive regulatory treatment of their investments in private credit. And so were that to change, were we actually to see any change in the way the insurance regulators look at this space, that would have big knock-on effects along the all the way down the asset class, because in many cases, those insurance companies are taking what we would call like a first out. So let's say hypothetically, an organization is going to write, a private credit firm will write a loan to a company, and the return is not quite high enough because, as I talked about, there's so many people bidding and competing on that. In order to create an attractive return profile, that private credit firm will then go to an insurance company and sell off the very first part of that. So let's say, hypothetically, they wrote a loan for 0 to 60%. They would then sell the 0 to 30%, so the most protected part of the structure, to an insurance company, and then they would retain 30 to 60. If that 0 to 30 were to go away, the returns are a lot less attractive for the private credit managers that retain that 30 to 60% LTV piece. So that's actually the one I would be most worried about if we were to see a change there.
Very interesting. So flipping back away from regulation now, back to the investment side. So you talked a little bit about floating rate instruments, and that's what most private credit is now. What other things, that helps a lot with the interest rate risk, but what other things are private credit lenders doing to help manage risk?
Well, one of the interesting areas in credit is actually, you know, we have had a lot of private credit focus here in the United States. What we're increasingly starting to see is more private credit, or at least conversations about the attractiveness of private credit in Europe. And so when we start to get into foreign currency, you know, there is different techniques for hedging foreign currency volatility. So, you know, you can't always predict when someone may pay you back. And so are you going to hedge just the coupon? Are you going to hedge the coupon plus a portion of the long-term maturity? Are you going to hedge the whole long-term balloon payment at the end? That's an area that we see different practices, different managers. The interest rate volatility itself, one thing that's interesting there is I think we've all had expected, probably going into the change in administration, for there to be a lower interest rates, meaning the SOFR was going to come down, so the base rate of our investments would basically make less money. Because we've seen those interest rates staying higher for longer, that's actually made this this asset class more attractive than I think we would have predicted 12 months ago. So that interest rate volatility and people not having to worry about that and hedge has been wonderful. Given that you can actually swap things in. And so we're seeing more managers be very tactical about actually taking the floating and swapping to fixed. Sometimes they're taking fixed and they're swapping back to floating. And so companies are getting very interesting. And I think private credit managers are using all the tools between hedging and interest rates to produce what they consider to be a great long-term rate of return. And so if you today have a 7% instrument, maybe you can give a little bit of that up and lock in a 6, and that way it won't be a 5 2 years from now. So there's a lot of different things that we're seeing people doing, and that's been one thing that's been really beneficial, and I think a surprise for many of us versus where we would have expected this to be 12 months ago.
Oh, very interesting. And another thing is there's been an uptick in liability management exercises, or LMEs. Not to be confused with the London Mercantile Exchange, but so what's driving this trend, and how are companies using LMEs to navigate financial challenges? And what do you see in there, and how has it played out successfully for you guys?
So this is one of my favorite topics. LMEs is just a very nice way of saying what we used to say, which was troubled debt restructurings. So there's a lot of words for it. LME is, as you say, a little bit of a confusing, it sounds kind of elevated. But what we've seen traditionally is, you know, these were practices in which a loan document has been written a certain way, and a company were to get into trouble. Like, so let's say they had a liquidity issue, or particularly they're worried about tariffs. You know, there's an impact of a tariff change. When the documents are loose, as I had referred to earlier, one of the things we've seen is that with more and more competition, and this we've always seen in the public credit market, but we're definitely seeing more in the private credit market bleed its way in. The looseness of those documents often allow the company to navigate. There's certain assets that are not fully locked down. There is effectively a an ability for them to go in and renegotiate. And so an LME effectively refers to the fact that if they have 51% of the loan, let's call it a loan in this case, if the loan group agrees, 51% of those folks can modify the document on behalf of the others. And there's a concept we call the in-group and the out-group. So you feel like you're almost in high school again, right? There's the in-crowd. You want to be in the in-crowd. You always do. The in-crowd would be the 51%, and they negotiate a certain arrangement in which often they are paid or they have preferential economics, they have preferential treatment. Versus the 49 that are left out. And so what you really want is, as a credit investor, you want to be with a manager who is going to get themselves into the in-group. Because to a certain extent, as long as a company can get 51% of the holders to agree to a modification, the LME is going to happen with you or without you. And so it's been a really interesting dynamic where you're effectively going and restructuring existing loan documents. And we could all write, there could be 5 hours on this particular topic, Scott. But LMEs are something that is supposed to be buying the company more time by giving them relief, whether that be of a covenant or of the amount of interest they're paying. Maybe they're converting into partial PIK. The idea is it's supposed to bridge a company to better health. And the belief, if you are not cynical, is that that will actually allow the company to reperform, and that is to the best interest of the equity and the credit holders in the long term. I think it's too early to say. You asked for an example of a successful LME. I think it's way too early to say. The very first LMEs we really have only seen, they've only been a couple years old. So we have not seen yet whether an LME transaction in this era has protected a company and got it to reperform in a way in which it does not file for bankruptcy or get into further trouble. So I'd say the jury is out. One kind of related concept that I just think is so interesting is, you know, when you're in school and you're taught about loans, you always think of, well, I'm the creditor, I will get paid first, right? That's just a fundamental principle we're all taught in finance and economics. And the way LMEs effectively work, that's no longer true. And so when you are sitting, as we are, as very large private equity investors, we kind of like this. We like it because the private equity sponsors who have purchased companies, and to be clear, it's not just private equity that can do an LME, but as they are often the most sophisticated investors, we are seeing more of them coming from the private sponsor crowd. So when that sponsor turns around and says, hey, I negotiated a pretty loose document, it's my fiduciary duty not to give that away to the creditors and to use that flexibility. The equity holders, you know, those of us who are investors, are kind of cheering them on. Then you have a private credit manager or credit manager. Often these are public, more a little more prevalent in the public market right now. If you have an investment there, again, you say, well, it's going to happen with or without us because there's goodies being distributed. And if you think, hey, there's a chance they're going to get to 51%, you just want to be in the in crowd versus the out crowd. And so those creditors that are participating are saying, hey, it's my fiduciary duty to protect my investors by getting them into the in crowd. And so there's really not a lot of ways to stop these LME transactions from happening, with one small note, which is that the creditors are getting smarter. The creditors are understanding that this is an increasing prevalent trend. There's a lot of law firms and investment banks that are going out and pitching people on, this is how we'll do an LME. You guys are a good candidate. We'll help guide you through it, you know, for a small, small fee, as our industry does. And so those creditors are getting together in something they call cooperative groups or co-op groups. And that is an attempt to say, hey, we're going to band together. And if we all go together and say, you're not going to do this to us, they will not be able to get to 51%, and we will all end up with a better outcome. And so we're just seeing that dynamic kind of going on and at play. And I think in large part, the co-op agreements are allowing there to be a better result that is protecting the creditors versus not having a cooperative group. So LMEs, it's a little early to say. It's certainly a huge amount of activity. There are now easily over 100 LME transactions that we have tracked. And, you know, if you don't have a co-op agreement, at the very least, you want to be in the in-group. But as an equity holder, we're happy for our private equity sponsors to be using that flexibility that they negotiated.
That is definitely a trend to keep our eye out on. And it sounds really interesting. And I'd love to see who is part of the in-group as we keep our eye out on that.
The popular crowd, yes.
Exactly. So to the SEC, they've made it clear that disclosures, valuations, fees, conflicts of interest continue to remain top priorities. What steps are you seeing fund managers take to stay compliant and continue to build investor trust with you guys?
You know, it's interesting. Texas Teachers is fortunate to be one of the largest investors in the United States in the public space with over $200 billion under management. So, you know, we have often found that disclosure fees, I mean, that really benefits the big guys, you know, and I think some of the work that the SEC had been doing kind of prior to the administration change had focused around trying to protect some of the smaller investors. From where we sit, it's kind of funny. You know, we hear a lot from managers. You know, they'll tell us, "Oh, well, you know, the SEC is making us. We can't agree to this because the SEC won't let us." We laugh at that often because the SEC really is a disclosure type of format. So the SEC is not saying at this point you can or cannot do X, Y, and Z. They're really just saying you need to be very clear with the investors that that's what you're doing. And so we've seen this take an interesting tact where, you know, the fee disclosure in a legal agreement between us and a private credit manager, for example, you know, it used to be like literally a page of here are all the things we can charge you for. That one page has now gone to three. And when you ask the managers about it, you know, they're like, "Oh, we're actually not charging you for anything we weren't. We're just being much more explicit about it." So if anything, I would say the SEC's focus is just related to more legal fees for us and more documents to wade through. You know, on the valuation front, you know, there are valuations, I think, valuing private credit, and this is going to make me sound a little bit unusual, you know, when you don't have liquidity available, you know, the valuations are indicative, if anything. There's a vast difference, and we can tell you occasionally in the private credit space, you see managers participate in what we call club transactions. And so what that means is there's not one private credit manager involved in making a loan, maybe there's five. And it just may be, coincidentally, that we invest with more than one manager who holds that loan. And I can tell you that they all have different valuations. And so I would say valuations are relative. Many of us who look at those, they're very assumption-based. And so, truthfully, we don't put a lot of weight on the valuations. And I'm sure all the valuation colleagues are not going to like the fact that I said that. But what we are much more focused on when we're monitoring is ensuring that we've got good disclosure and robust conversations around where we're seeing modifications to a loan document, where we're seeing any kind of changes or amendments, and where we're seeing extensions or LME transactions. So that's our biggest focus. And I haven't seen the SEC talking specifically about how fund managers handle those issues, but that's where we spend our time.
I still think it's really good information to know from an investor standpoint. Here's what we're focused on in this space and what you guys, if you're looking to come talk to us and seek capital from us, this is what we're seeking to make sure we understand what's going on with your business.
I'll laugh and just share with you this little tidbit. We have so many managers who come in and say, "Oh, we have a zero loss ratio or a 10 basis point realized loss ratio." And we just kind of laugh and we're like, "That's great." So, you know, and they want to talk about, "Oh, we have a very low default rate." And we say, "Great, show me all your modifications." Right? Because you can modify your way out of default. So, you know, some of the headline numbers or the headline statements that people would make, realized losses are not as prevalent. If you only have a three-year track record, of course you don't have very many realized losses because you're still in the first iteration of your loans. So it's always the longer dated ones that have the biggest issues. And you really want to be looking for modifications and asking questions about that, not necessarily looking exactly what the manager wants you to look at, but really going one level deeper.
Well, Ashley, it's been a real pleasure having you on. That's a wrap for today's episode of Texas Trends Talks. We want to thank you, Ashley, again for joining us and sharing your insights. And to our listeners, we want to thank you guys for tuning in. If you enjoyed this conversation, be sure to subscribe, leave a comment, share this episode with those in your network, and we'll be back with more trends, insights, and voices that shape Texas and beyond. Until next time, take care.
And everybody go thank a teacher.
Thanks so much, Ashley. This was great.
You're welcome.
Thank you for listening to the KPMG Texas Trend Talks podcast. To stay updated on the latest trends from industry leaders, be sure to subscribe to the series or follow us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts.